Heard. I heard the word champion.
The making of a champion, next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Saturdays at 3 on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Michelle Martin is away. As we know, ceasefire arrangements have failed between Hamas and Israel, and violence continues to flare, threatening all-out war. More than 200 Palestinians, according to Gaza health officials, have been killed, and one Israeli to date. It makes some of us, though, think about how over the decades, many have sought common ground and understanding. In 2001, I interviewed the late Kashmiri poet, Agha Shahid Ali, who was collaborating with the Israeli-born poet Izhar Patkin in New York. Shahid was a wonderful poet. One of his lines from his last collection, The Veiled Sweet, is, "I wait for him to look straight into my eyes. This is our only chance for magnificence." He died of brain cancer before Patkin's installation could be finished. Now, in his take on their shared work, called The Wandering Veil, Izhar Patkin has a series of rooms up at Mass MoCA in Massachusetts. It's a good setting for the group ArtsBridge, which brings together Israeli and Palestinian young people to work on creative projects in the U.S. Patkin talked to two of them last week. Izhar Patkin joins us from our bureau in New York. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Jackie.
And also joining us from member station WAMC in Albany are two young members of ArtsBridge. Palestinian Yazan Assad is a facilitator and former participant, and Ofri Peretz from Israel is a current participant in the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Happy to be here.
We're happy that you came. So, Izhar Patkin, maybe you'd begin. I know that you talked to the ArtsBridge youths in front of an installation work of your own at Mass MoCA. Describe for us a little bit what that installation is, would you please?
It's a very massive show, but at the heart of it is my collaboration with the great late Kashmiri poet Agha Shahid Ali. There are five rooms in the show that are rooms painted on tulle veils, and each room is an adaptation of another poem of Shahid. The tulle veils naturally turn the images into kind of ghostly images, and it suited very well many of the subjects that Shahid and I were interested in, subjects of loss, of destiny, of memory, of love and death.
And I just want to say I was able to interview you and Shahid just before he passed away. He was certainly someone who promoted dialogue, especially when it's difficult, especially between Muslims and Jews.
Yes, he was. And he did it in the most deep and lighthearted way, equally.
So, Ofri Peretz, you are 16 years old. Why did you want to participate in the ArtsBridge program this summer?
Well, I always had the tendency to look in more to the meaning of art. And I think art is a beautiful language that can say anything and go through the most shut down hearts. And I think that is exactly what we need in our conflict in Israel, from what I have seen in my short 16 years. People just don't listen to each other. And that makes us drift apart and not care about the other's hardships and hurt.
And Yazan, Assad, I know you're 22 now. How old were you when you got involved with ArtsBridge, and why did you want to get enrolled?
It was in 2008, the first time. It was the very first year of ArtsBridge, and I was 16 at the time. And when I first heard about ArtsBridge, my very thought was, okay, I've been living here for 16 years, and I've never spoken to anyone from the other side. So I decided just to take a step up and to sign up for the program and just to go there and hear what the other side has to say about all of this, the conflict, the situation, the region.
Where exactly are you from?
I'm from a place called Kalandia, which is in Palestine, the West Bank. And it's basically a very large checkpoint built on next to a refugee camp. And I live very close to that checkpoint.
Ofri Peretz, obviously you've come to the U.S. from Israel. You must have made that decision some time ago. How have the events of the summer affected your decision and affected your time here?
For one minute, I do not regret to decide to participate in such a program. And I think it's even more important to participate in a program like this, in mm-hmm. times like this. You know, because when you're in Israel, I think it's more comfortable to sit in distance from Palestinians and hear this type of difficult news. But when you are together, when you experience daily life together, when you live and see those people every day, you see the new face, the human faces behind the conflict, you know, the human emotions and the feelings. You learn how to really listen.
Where do you live in Israel?
I live in the north part of Israel, about 15 minutes from Haifa.
And what are you hearing from your community there?
I hear that 40,000 people have been drafted to the military, and in my city there have been attempted kidnaps, which kind of dismantles my sense of security for the people that I care about in that area. There have been some rockets from Lebanon that I know. Other than that, the news is pretty much the same.
Is there any way, Yazin, that your art is going to reflect what's going on? Or what was there an incident that drew you in when you were a teen?
Well, for me, I'm a film facilitator at Artsbridge. And, of course, film is also a very powerful way of showing what you want to say about the situation or the conflict or what you want to say about the subject. Just now, actually, in Artsbridge, the students just began their filming process. And there are they had lots of struggles, you know, just coming up with ideas. So at some point, each one of them will be just sitting down and saying, we should show the Israelis like this, and we should show the Palestinians like this, and we should show, how are we going to show that this is a Palestinian, and how are we going to show this is an Israeli, you know, this. And also, like, we should film here, we shouldn't film here, because this will show, like, a pro-Israeli place or as a pro-Palestinian place, you know. But at the end, like, all of them, by the end of the argument, got to a compromise and managed to come up with an amazing script that they're starting to film tomorrow, hopefully.
So it's difficult because everything gets coded and everything's coded for something else.
That's pretty much what happens at some point, yes.
Izar, was there an impulse like that behind your collaboration with Shahid?
The impulse to decode, for mm-hmm. sure. Mm-hmm. For sure, that's at the heart of making art, poetry. One of the interesting moments when talking with the kids from Artsbridge is when we entered one of the rooms that's a big painting painted on tulle veils, very ethereal. The room is after a poem by Faiz, Ahmed Faiz, which Shahid had adapted to English. It's called You Tell Us What to Do. And what I did in that room is a scene that happens on the beach between Tel Aviv and Jaffa, between the new Jewish city and the old Arab city. And on that beach, I painted on the veils the ghost images of both Jewish refugees coming in to Palestine from Europe in the 40s and of Palestinian refugees escaping on the beaches of Gaza in the Second Intifada. And there, we're both presented there as equal ghosts, ghosts being unresolved emotions. It's not a news story, it's not a didactic story, but it's there as a painting and as a metaphor.
And not something that the populations would often see in the same space.
And it's one of the few moments, you know, being art, where the threat is taken out of the equation and you can just see the images and just take it in.
So, Ofri, what do you plan to do in Artsbridge this summer or when you return to Israel? Are you part of the film or are you making some other kind of work?
I am part of the film.
What's the name of the film going to be?
The Dawn of Fear.
The Dawn of Fear.
Yeah.
Right.
We have decided that we want to focus on our piece about the conflict in your head. How is this? Does that affect real conflict going on? Because we believe that it's 50-50, you know, it's 50% the attitude that you come to and 50% what really goes on. So the plot will follow three characters, Palestinian, American, and Israeli. Each one of them doing everyday activities, and they are hit with certain sounds that make them split back into traumas of the past. For example, the Israeli character will split back into a flashback of missiles being launched in his house. The Palestinian character will split back into a flashback of soldier coming into his house in the middle of the night.
I think it's kind of, this is the first I heard of the name of the movie, The Dawn of Fear, which is terrific. And it reminds me of the moment when Shahid and I decided to do this collaboration between a Muslim and a Jew, and we thought the Muslim and the Jew should meet on the veil. And we called our collaboration, our working title was Veiled Threats. So it kind of, their title takes me back to that moment of the beginning of our collaboration.
Before I let you go, I'd like to know, we don't know as we're sitting here what the news cycle will continue to be, and the news has been grim and anxiety-provoking. Does a program like this one give you some hope as you think about going home? Ofri?
It doesn't only give me a little bit of hope. I think that a greater person of me has once said that the future is what you make of it, and the best way to predict the future is to make it. I think that a program like ArtsBridge that really gives you the ability to listen, and it's really difficult, by the way, can also give you the ability to believe in yourself and in the people that you carry around with you in this journey to change the reality. So I think the future will be great.
Yasin?
If I think that there's no hope, I wouldn't have been in this program for 6 years now. The program happening here is by itself a spark of hope despite everything that's happening in the region.
Ofri Peretz and Yasin Assad are members of the group ArtsBridge. We thank you so very much for coming in. It was fantastic to talk to you.
Thank you.
And Izhar Patkin is an Israeli artist and activist with the current show Izhar Patkin, The Wandering Veil, which you can see all summer at Mass MoCA in Massachusetts. Thank you, Izhar.
Thank you, Jackie.
Coming up, clothing is our common connection. Fashion icon Donna Karan has just introduced a line tailored specifically for Muslim women observing Ramadan. Washington Post fashion critic Robin Gavan joins me to discuss this and more. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. Next time on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia, we'll revisit some of our more crafty and sneaky games in our really hard edition.
The Great Gatsby Beetle Bailey?
Yes!
Yes.
I don't get it.
Join me, Ophir Eisenberg, for NPR's guiltiest and most puzzling pleasure, Ask Me Another.
Saturday morning at 11 on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Michelle Martin is away. Cory Booker was in the political spotlight long before he was sworn in as New Jersey's junior senator in 2014. His first campaign to become mayor of Newark was the focus of an award-winning documentary. Part of his term in that office was chronicled in a television series for the Sundance Channel. Now that he's in Washington, Senator Booker is creating a reputation as a political bridge builder. His latest collaboration across the aisle is called the Redeem Act. It's an attempt to reform the criminal justice system, and Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky is its co-sponsor. Senator Cory Booker joins us now to talk about the Redeem Act from his Washington office. Senator, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
So as briefly as you can, tell those who don't know what the Redeem Act calls for, please.
Well, it's this understanding that as Americans, we have about 4 to 5% of the globe's population, but 25% of the globe's imprisoned people, costing taxpayers almost $250 billion a year. We're all paying the expense of it, and we're undermining our prison systems, our criminal justice system, and people recidivated at alarming rates. About 3 out of 4 people recidivate every 5 years. And so the REDEEM Act does very common sense things that actually empower people to be economically more productive and to recidivate less, thus saving taxpayers money.
Well, let's look at some of those specifics. What exactly would it do? We know we have a disproportionate prison population. How does this reduce it?
Well, I found out in my days as a mayor of New Jersey's largest city that a lot of folks will come out and want to work, but find it very hard to get a job. As nonviolent drug offenders, they'll apply for jobs, and suddenly they'll find out that they don't want to be hired because they committed a crime. They'll apply for business licenses, and again, you can't because you committed that nonviolent drug offense. So what it does is it provides a pathway, number one, for sealing of records where you can apply back to a judge for a nonviolent crime. For juveniles, for kids that commit a nonviolent crime when they're young, it provides for the automatic sealing of their records. It improves the FBI background check, which often companies will do, and many people don't realize this, with 17 million background checks done. Many studies say that up to half of those background check results are incomplete or inaccurate, often causing someone to lose a job opportunity because of the mistakes that the FBI background check system made. Mm-hmm. It also says, well, when young people are incarcerated, let's stop doing practices that some countries even consider torture. One of that practices specifically is solitary confinement, which for young people, over half the suicides in prisons are happening when a child is in solitary confinement.
I also wanted to focus in on another change known as ban the box. Could you explain what that is, please?
Yes, yeah, sure. It's many, many local states and localities, including in New Jersey, are saying that, wait a minute, for jobs that have nothing to do with whether a person committed a nonviolent drug offense or not, why are we still asking that question? Remember, the last three presidents of the United States have admitted in one way or another to doing nonviolent drug offenses, in other words, smoking marijuana or something like that, and America hired those people for the top job in the land. Why do we have a lot of jobs that may have nothing to do where even the use of drugs would have an impact, especially if it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago? Why are we even asking that question? So this bill doesn't specifically have anything in it for ban the box, but I'm encouraged by that movement that's going on around the country because, again, this is about giving people the chance who've really paid their price, who've served their time, giving them a chance to be economically productive again. One of the things where we stop people from getting food stamps, we stop people from getting Pell Grants, we stop people from getting a lot of things that might happen that can help them stay on their feet or better their education or better their ability to be economically productive.
Well, let me ask you about that, though. By ending barriers that keep ex-offenders from benefits like food stamps or subsidized housing, in this political climate, a lot of these safety net programs, as you know, are really vulnerable. Do you have any concern that by adding former offenders to these programs, it could endanger the programs for everyone?
Well, no, I don't, especially because if you start to appeal to people's sort of economic logic, conservatives and Democrats have a strong feeling of this idea of fairness, redemption, and, in fact, this idea that, hey, we should try to help people economically be productive and contribute. There's a lot of folks who are beginning to say, why are we over-punishing somebody, especially compared to some other crimes that might even be violent, where those kind of bans never take place? We have, in many ways, overreached when it comes to drug laws and caused many of the very problems that we were hoping to solve.
Your partner on this legislation is Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who's a potential candidate for president in 2016. He's got quite a history of controversial statements about civil rights. And I'm just wondering, as one of only two African-American senators, are you concerned that his work with you might be used to obscure his record on race?
You know, the urgency for me in solving problems now and not worrying about the next election, or in this case, the election after the next election, I really came down here to focus on trying to move the bar substantively in important policy areas that ultimately empower people, my state and our nation.
You two have worked together on a couple of things, I believe.
Yeah, you know, another common sense thing we just said is that a lot of states right now are passing medical marijuana laws, making marijuana a medicine available for people that are very, very sick. States have made that decision, and the federal government, in my opinion, shouldn't be going in and prosecuting people who are abiding by state law and using medical marijuana to help them with their disease.
Please don't take this the wrong way, Senator, but just looking at a couple of the headlines with you two, is it a budding bromance now that you're on Capitol Hill?
You know, I was one of those Americans that was very frustrated with looking down Washington and seeing too much partisanship. And so I'll work with anybody down here if they share sort of my ideas about how to make life better in New Jersey and our nation. And so Rand Paul and I have a lot of things we disagree on. I could write a dissertation on our disagreements, but I'm searching for common ground. And with him, I found a lot when it comes to reforming our criminal justice system, saving taxpayer dollars, and empowering people, many of whom I know, to be successful in life.
Senator Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey, joined us by phone from his office in Washington on Capitol Hill. Senator, thank you so very much again.
Thank you so much, and thanks for focusing so much on this issue.
Now we shift our focus from the political to the sartorial. And there's no one better for sartorial splendor and sense than Pulitzer Prize-winning fashion critic Robin Givhan, whose aesthetic and economic and historical perspectives inform her commentary. Robin joins me to discuss a range of headlines, seemly and not, from the fashion world, from her office at the Washington Post. Robin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jackie. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. And welcome back to town. You were living and writing in New York for a while.
I was, but it's nice to be back in D.C. and back at the Post.
So speaking of New York, I was just struck, and maybe you were too, by the news that Donna Karan, this global designer, has a new line of garments for Ramadan, the Muslim holiday. And the Times of Israel took note of that as she's mm-hmm. Jewish. And I think this is a first for Donna Karan, this kind of line. And as a former Middle East correspondent, I was really struck by that. What's your take?
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, I do not recall another instance when Donna Karan's done something like this. But, you know, maybe I'm being a little bit cynical. I think that it's a lovely idea, but I would note that, you know, she's not doing a collection for the Amish. There are a lot of fashion customers in the Middle East, and there is a lot of money in the Middle East. And as designers look at a business that is becoming ever more global, you know, some of the largest growing markets are in the Middle East. So it makes a lot of business sense to do it.
Yes, and we should probably note that this line is available just in her stores in Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. So she's really designing specifically for these customers. Have you looked at the actual clothes?
I have, and you know, I've given them a quick pass, and I think that they certainly are in keeping with her aesthetic, which I think is the most important thing. I mean, as you sort of try and cater to different markets and different customers, the one thing that you don't want as a designer that you don't want to lose is your aesthetic sensibility, because that's what has drawn the customers to you in the first place. So a lot of it, I think, has to do with sort of selecting the right pieces from the collection and also styling them in a way that is appropriate.
Let me ask you a little more general question. When is it cultural commodification, and when is it appropriate for a designer to try something new? I mean, designers are inspired by events and symbols and traditions all over the world. But as you said at the outset, sometimes we're skeptical, too.
Yeah, and I think it's a really fuzzy line sometimes, but often, you know, the offense is from the perspective of the person whose culture, whose religion, whose tradition is being used. And I think they're the ones who ultimately can say whether or not something is appropriate or whether something is offensive. But I do think that there are a certain group of warning signs, and one is that, you know, if it is respectful of the tradition and if it's attempting to keep some of the context out of which it came, then I think those two things generally are very helpful in keeping it from being offensive.
Yeah. Robin, I also want to note that we have seen the passing of Eileen Ford at age 92. She was, of course, the creator of Ford Models, a woman who left her legacy on four decades of fashion. I want to play a quick clip from 1987. My colleague Scott Simon interviewed her. It was a really testy and funny exchange.
Why is it impossible to accept the fact that there's somebody older, who doesn't have wide-set eyes, who doesn't have the long neck, who nonetheless communicates something extraordinary by
Listen,
way of real
why don't you start a model agency and you sell those girls? You've got to get them work. And if I don't provide work, I'm not a good agent. And if there's no demand for that look, then there's no reason for me to supply it, because who am I going to supply it to? You.
I thought that was great. And she goes on to say, look, if people want wide-set eyes and short statures, I'll supply that too. Do we have Eileen Ford to blame for the sort of ectomorph look?
Well,
or to credit?
I don't know if we should credit her or blame her, but I do think that she had a really good point, which is basically that fashion is at that level is a fantasy, and that she was supplying women who could essentially help perpetuate, help bring to life that fantasy. So if we have anyone to blame, I would say that, you know, we have ourselves to blame, because we are the ones who crave that fantasy, despite what we often say publicly.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us today. Robin Givhan is the fashion critic for The Washington Post, and she joined us from their studios. Thank you. Time now to hear the latest interview from StoryCorps' new initiative called Out Loud. It records and amplifies the voices of the LGBTQ community. Today, we'll hear from Alexis Martinez, who is a transgender woman. She was born Arthur in 1950 and grew up in a rough housing project on Chicago's South Side. Alexis eventually got married and had a child. It's only in the last few years that she's been living as a woman full time. But as she told her daughter, Leslie, she knew she was a trans woman from a young age.
When I came out to my mom that I was transgender, I think I was 13 or 14, and she called the police, and I always remember that when the police showed up, you know, they just laughed and told her, you got a fag for a son, and there's nothing we can do about it. You know, so I went as macho as I could be, you know, to mask what I really was underneath. And by that time, I had become a member of a gang. Mm-hmm. People just didn't mess with me, you know, because they knew they had a fight on their hands. When I look back at it, it was almost schizophrenic, because I would be wearing combat boots and blue jeans and a leather jacket, but underneath I would have like stockings and a bra. And so I remember it as a very dark period. I mean, I really didn't believe that anybody could love somebody like me.
I remember as a little girl that you would say these things like, well, I know that I'm not loved. I just remember growing up like, Daddy, I love you. You know, it was just such an important thing for me to express to you how much you mattered. And it was a big to-do. I discovered some female clothes. It was sort of, you know, my uncovering the secret.
You asked me why. And I think if I had tried to cover it up, a lot of trust would have been lost between us.
It was like freedom, because now I could talk to you freely about being a girl, you know, and you're the one who taught me to put on makeup.
You know, I was really torn between being a female role model and a dad. And so I said to myself, okay, well, be the best parent. Whatever it takes, however I do it, you have to look out for your baby. But one of the most difficult things for me was I was always afraid that I wouldn't be allowed to be in my granddaughter's lives. And you blew that completely out of the water, you and your husband. One of the fruits of that is You know, my relationship with my granddaughters, they fight with each other sometimes over whether I'm he or she, you know.
But they're free to talk about it.
They're free to talk about it, but that to me is a miracle.
You don't have to apologize. You don't have to tiptoe. You know, we're not going to cut you off. And that is something I've always wanted you to, you know, just know that you're loved.
You know, I live this every day now. I walk down the streets as a woman, and I really am at peace with who I am. I mean, I wish I had a softer voice, maybe, you know, but now I walk in love, and I try to live that way every day.
Alexis Martinez speaking with her daughter, Leslie, at StoryCorps in Chicago. Their interview is part of StoryCorps Out Loud, recording the stories of the LGBTQ community. And if there's someone you'd like to interview or to add your own story to the Library of Congress, visit StoryCorps.org. You can hear more StoryCorps on their podcast. It's also on iTunes and NPR.org. Coming up, Tara Kamangar is a classical pianist and composer who digs to find the stories behind the pieces she plays. Her new album, East of Melancholy, traces shared themes between Russian and Iranian music dating all the way back to 4000 BC. She tells us about some of what she found. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts since 1985. CySimsFoundation.org, and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Boko Haram, the Islamist militant group which kidnapped more than 260 girls from a school in northern Nigeria. We talk with Alex Perry, who wrote the Newsweek cover story about the group and has written a new book called The Hunt for Boko Haram. We'll talk about the group's founder, its current leader, and how it tries to justify the atrocities it's committed. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Tune in to WILL-TV as our Fund Your Favorite summer schedule continues. We asked our supporters to program Friday nights on WILL-TV this summer by voting for their favorite programs. First, watch the final installment of Ken Burns' stunning six-part documentary series, The National Parks. Then, on Nature, join Sir David Attenborough as he looks back on his wildlife filmmaking career in Life on Camera. It all starts Friday night at 8 on WILL-TV.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Michelle Martin is away. Classical pianist and composer Tara Kamangar grew up in Central California's agricultural regions. Her father had given up medicine in Iran and become a fig farmer in the United States. You can hear the layers of her heritage from Persia's rich history, which she brings to the concert halls of Los Angeles and New York. In her new album, East of Melancholy, she guides us along the 1,200-mile border that Iran shares with Russia, a rich history in the area of the Caspian Sea and the Caucasus Mountains, dating back to at least 4,000 BC. In both countries, music has been a passion and articulation of identities, and also sporadically suppressed. You're listening now to The Lark, composed by the father of Russian classical music, Mikhail Glinka. Tara Kamangar joins us now from our studios in New York City. Tara, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jackie, for having me.
I have absolutely loved reading descriptions of these works. I've been lucky enough to visit some of that territory. And I'm thinking of the poetry, the migrations, the revolutions, both former empires. East of Melancholy, elaborate on that just a little bit.
The title, East of Melancholy, I chose because it's the translated title of a book of poems by an Iranian contemporary poet, Sohrab Sepehri, and I think it speaks to the fact that a lot of the pieces on the album are inspired by poetry, both the Persian and Russian ones.
Well, I also note in your work here that the Russian composers were really influenced by folk music from the Caucasus, and there's a great quote by Glinka, who lived between 1804 and 1857, he says, "Love with us is always mixed with sorrow. There's no doubt that our melancholy, our plaintive song, which is the child of the North, also has an Oriental strain. Just listen to the Volga boatman's mournful song. One almost feels the Tatars' domination." And that's going back to the 19th century. So you're really drawing on strains of this mixing.
Yes, yeah, I love that quote. There's a Russian proverb that says, "Scratch a Russian and you'll find a Tatar." Also, with Glinka, it's interesting that he is known as the father of Russian classical music, and he was also moving around a lot. He had a cosmopolitan upbringing, and he was taught several languages as a child, including Persian. And he went on to write the first opera. Sung in Russian, based on Russian folk music, and he inspired so many composers after him. Even like Chechnovorian wrote the first opera sung in Farsi.
Let's listen to the Fantastic Dances clip. This is the Dance of Elegy. Tell us what's going on here.
This is a work by Chechnovorian. He was born in Iran, but of an Armenian family. And he was actually the conductor of the Armenian Philharmonic for 10 years. And this particular suite, The Fantastic Dances, was written when he was only 20 years old. I got the score directly from Chechnovorian. He's still really active in Iran. He just finished his sixth opera, and he's doing such amazing work under such restrictions. For example, one of his operas wasn't allowed to be performed in Iran due to the women and men not being able to sing together, and they performed it as a puppet opera, and it's really, I have a film of it, and it's really mesmerizing.
Wow. So here's a composer, Mr. Chechnovorian, working under these really difficult circumstances, but he has at least managed to accomplish many, many pieces. Mm-hmm. What was the effect of the 1979 revolution on classical music in Iran?
So all the pieces on this album were composed before the 1979 revolution. Of course, there's a lot being composed today, but I felt that a lot of these works were being sort of forgotten. The effect of the revolution was that a lot of the best performers and teachers left the country, and so there were few performers remaining in Iran to preserve and promote the works. And also, prior to 1979, there was a lot of funding going into Western classical music. For instance, they had the annual Shiraz Festival, which was a music festival set in the ruins of Persepolis, mm-hmm. with artists coming from all over the world, like, for instance, Yehudi Menuhin and Stockhausen, John Cage, Ravi Shankar, etc., etc. And after 1979, that was discontinued. And also, even during the Iran-Iraq War, there was really no music performance allowed during this time. The atmosphere was kind of perpetual mourning, mm-hmm. and actually selling pianos was even banned during that time.
Let's go to this track. I want to play a little bit from Spartacus. Never heard of Aram Khachaturian and this ballet that we're hearing, Spartacus. This is one where there's a love theme. We are seeing the reunion of the hero and his wife, and you write that it's in the style of a classical Armenian lament. A lot of lamentation going on in general in these pieces.
Yes, and I think you can hear in Armenian music, you often have this descending chromatic line, and you have that in this work, and I just love the harmony changes. This is originally a ballet, and it was arranged for piano just a few years ago by a Brooklyn-based pianist, Matthew Cameron, and I first discovered this from a performance of his on YouTube before the score was actually printed. And I just fell in love with it. I couldn't stop. I watched it on repeat. And I learned it from ear because the score wasn't available and I couldn't get in touch with him.
I'd like to be just a little personal. Tell us a little bit about your own family. Your father left the practice of medicine in Iran before the revolution. You have two brothers. One of them, Solar, has quite a high profile in tech. How do they inspire you?
We're a very close family, so I'm really lucky to have very supportive parents. Many parents probably wouldn't like that their child becomes a musician. They prefer a more stable profession, but my parents are big music lovers. My mom studied the piano in Tehran, and my dad studied the violin and all Persian instruments. And he wanted to be actually a professional violinist, and his father told him that musicians aren't respected enough in Iran, so if you want to be a musician, you should move west, but if you stay here, you should be a doctor. So I think for my brothers and I, we actually all play piano and violin, and music is kind of what we all have in common as a family.
Has your brother Salar encouraged you to put these pieces on YouTube?
I kind of did that myself, but I think he was think he was happy about it. He is a great pianist himself, and we play duets together. So he's always been supportive.
I just thought, as the former CEO of YouTube, he might have, I don't know, done a workaround or something for you.
That would be great. I wish he could up my view counts.
Exactly. So when you perform these pieces now, what kinds of audiences are you searching for in terms of their own backgrounds or age range or parts of the country?
I really would love for this music to be heard. I think anyone who hears it will appreciate it and maybe be interested even to learn more about Iran. I know some of my American friends, after seeing Persian miniature paintings or hearing Persian poetry, they were inspired to learn Farsi or learn more about the country, and that's always been the case for me for other cultures. I'm hoping that the inclusion of the Russian Romantic composers, so the more familiar works, will encourage more people to pick up the album, because I know that I probably wouldn't pick up an album of completely unknown works, but hopefully the Russian works will serve as a good bridge to the Iranian ones.
Absolutely, and I can say that there's a love story behind almost any one of these pieces, and you've got a lot of those. This is classical music with a backstory.
Yes, I love that about it. I love knowing the story behind the work.
Let's go out on Etude. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this piece?
Sure. That's a composition of mine that I included in the album. And I thought it fit into the album due to the mood of the piece. It's definitely melancholic and restless. So I think it works with the flow of the album.
I've been speaking with classical pianist and composer Tara Kamangar. Her new album is called East of Melancholy, and she joined us from our New York bureau. Tara, thank you so much for speaking with us. It's an exquisite album.
Thank you so much for having me.
And finally, as this program winds down, the last broadcast is scheduled for August the 1st, we thought it would be nice to hear what music members of our staff are listening to as part of our series, In Your Ear. Devar Ardalan has been the senior producer of Tell Me More for the past 3 years. Let's hear what's on her playlist.
The first song that I'm listening to is called Song of Exile, and it's by a musical group known as Niyaz. Niyaz means yearning, and what I love about this musical group is that they combine Persian and Indian folk songs with modern electronica and Sufi mystical poetry. The singer's name is Azam Ali, and she says, "If I were to reunite with you just one more time, I would reveal to you the anguish of my exile." What I appreciate is the dynamic pace and the changing rhythm of the voice and instrumentation. And I get the same kind of mystical experience or sensation when I listen to Josh Garrels. He's a folk artist based in Portland, Oregon, and similar to Niyaz, Josh Garrels also writes about life and longing. This is from his album Love and War and the Sea in Between, and it's called Farther Along. There's so much more to life than we've been told. It's full of beauty that will unfold and shine like you struck gold, my wayward son. The dead weight burden weighs a ton. I'll go down to the river and let it run. Wash away all the things you've done. Forgiveness, all right. Fire. Gerald's and Nia's both have a powerful musicality that I love listening to in my very long commute back and forth to work. And in those times when I feel most exhausted and overwhelmed, I turn up the dial and listen to this music. This one is called Doña by Nia's, which means world. And it has a calming effect. It takes me into a different realm, at the edge of myself, almost. Sometimes remembering my magical childhood, other times dreaming of a more simple and less complicated future.
That was Tell Me More, senior producer Devar Ardalan, telling us what's playing in her ear. And that's our program for today. I'm Jackie Leiden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin will be back for more talk tomorrow.